Welcome to Charlotte Readers Podcast, where authors give voice to their written words. This is the show where we meet Charlotte area authors and authors who visit the Queen City, and we hear them read their work. Our sponsor for the first season is Park Road Books, the oldest and only full-service independent bookstore in Charlotte. They're located in Park Road Shopping Center. They've got a great staff and an awesome collection of books. And if they don't have something in stock that you want, they can order it for you and have it there quickly. And please check out our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. You can get information about the show and about our guest authors. We'd love to have you become a regular listener. You can listen on iTunes or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And on our website, you can sign up for our email list. We promise not to spam you, just give you updates from time to time about the show. And if you do join, as a thank you, we'll give you a free ebook, the first in a trilogy written by your host. I'm your host, Landis Wade. Thank you for listening. Today we'll hear from Charlotte author Paul Reale. Paul reads several of his short stories, starting with How to Wake Up. Good place to start. It was the flash fiction winner of the Ruth Moose Flash Fiction Contest put on by the Charlotte Writers Club. He also has a short piece called The Window. The piece has a double meaning that will become more clear toward the end. And then finally, he's got a piece that explores domestic violence and the characters that are exposed to that difficult situation. So we're going to start with How to Wake Up.
How to wake up. There are two ways to wake up. That's how she thinks about it. Two ways only. One, wake in fear, then find that all is well. Then laugh at herself for this irrationality, this tendency to let the dreams seep into the day. Laugh at her tendency to catastrophize. Or two, wake feeling contented, safe, happy, only to have it slide away. To remember what sleep had been trying to forget. At least, there used to be two ways. For the past 5 weeks and 3 days, she wakes only the second way, to a calm that slowly gives way to panic. This morning, she wakes as she has on each of these 38 days. She wakes feeling safe, blissful, right with the world. And for a few protected seconds, she feels only the warm embrace of a blanket and a thought, all is well, as if what happened had not happened. Then she remembers. It floods into her, the weight of it presses her down. The blanket is concrete, she cannot move beneath it. She will be trapped here, the truth will suffocate her. All is not well. She has not yet turned to look at the space next to her, the other side of the bed, a space where she does not sleep, does not venture, does not allow even her foot to cross. A foreign land, a boundary heavily fortified, lethal to cross. She wonders, if she turns her head to look, what will she see there? Will the space be empty? Will it be true that her husband is dead, is gone, in the ground, slowly turning to dust? Or will he be there still, still her husband, with all those promised years ahead of them? She gingerly turns her head, a fragile thing. She waits for the stem of her neck to break, for her head to roll away on its own, for heart and lungs, hope and soul to escape the hole of her neck. She turns her head, and there is her husband. He is not dead, not dead, not buried, not gone. He's there. Her not dead husband, right goddamn there. God damn it, God save her, God forgive her. Of course he's not dead. She has only just married him 5 weeks and 3 days ago. She is trapped here, trapped in this mistake. Again this morning, just after she wakes, she feels the sharp teeth of this trap. She is an animal clamped tight in this man-made monstrosity, still coming to terms with her imprisonment, wondering what it would mean to chew off her own leg to get free. Now a new feeling overtakes her, a slow spreading wave. Her hand is drawn to her belly. She knows, just knows, that she is pregnant. From crossing the boundary to the bed's other side on their wedding night, tied to him now, even knowing she'll never cross that boundary again, will never let his hands near her. but also knowing that now he will never let her go. All is not well, an understatement, a bon mot, a joke she has somehow played on herself. She corrects herself. There are three ways to wake up. The third way is to wake feeling it's been all shot to hell, and seconds later, as she emerges from sleep's grand delusions, finding it is true. Waking this way, there is no relief, not even for a few seconds. She thinks maybe she has made it through these 5 weeks and 3 days, only because of those precious and peaceful seconds before she remembers. But she fears even that is now to be denied her. She looks across the bed at him, her husband. The very word sickens her. This third way, she thinks, regret, giving way to deeper regret, is how she'll wake from now on. Unless she can find the fourth way, to wake in bliss and remain in bliss, the way a woman might wake with a baby asleep inside her or beside her, a baby that is hers and hers alone, free from the trap and its sharp teeth. She rises from the bed, stands and looks at the hunter on the other side, the creature who waited until their wedding night to reveal his true nature, to spring his trap. She looks, rubs her fingertips on her stomach, and knows what she must do. She does not need a new way to wake up. She needs a new way to be awake.
Author Paul Reale is co-founder of Charlotte Center for Literary Arts, otherwise known as Charlotte Lit, a nonprofit dedicated to elevating the literary arts in the Charlotte area. He's the co-author of Creativity Rising, a why-to and how-to guide to finding creative solutions that has sold more than 10,000 copies. And he's the co-editor of 3 volumes in the Big Questions in Creativity series from ICSC Press. His articles and essays have been published in more than a dozen publications, including the Winston-Salem Journal, Inspire Magazine, Lawyers Weekly, North Carolina Entrepreneur, and Office Solutions. And among other honors, Paul has won first place in several Charlotte Writers Club contests, including the pieces that you'll hear today. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, Linus. It's good to be here.
So, how to wake up. When I first saw the title, I thought this might be a cheery, cheery little piece.
There's no happiness in that piece.
No, and I also thought that must have been a really bad 5 weeks for this woman.
Well, it's a... trying to encapsulate a very short period of time in a piece of flash fiction, they have to be really about one very specific thing, and it's got a notion of how to compress time.
Do you think that people are often deceived to this extent? I mean, this was kind of a shocking thing, right? 5 weeks in, and on the wedding night, finds out this trap has been sprung.
Well, it was based very loosely on a true story. There was a good friend of mine who had this lovely whirlwind romance, been a man that everyone liked, and she realized on their wedding night after they were married that he was not who he had pretended to be.
Wow.
And then I saw this happen again to a relative where the groom, the husband-to-be, hid his illnesses, his mental illnesses, until after they were married, and with consequences.
You kind of pull us into this story at the beginning, and you almost feel, this is, of course, my interpretation, you almost feel sympathy for the woman who's lost her husband. I mean, that's sort of where you're leading us originally, and then you totally flip on us, and now we want him gone out of our life.
Girl, I'm glad you got the flip there. That was intentional.
This idea of waking up in your own life, how do you wake up?
Well, there's a term that my colleague Kathy Collins taught me about liminal space, and that those lovely few moments right at first waking, where most of the time they are peaceful moments. The actual concerns of life, concerns of the day, haven't quite seeped in yet. But there are those few days when I wake up and I feel like something's wrong, and I have to determine whether something really is wrong, whether there's something I went to bed concerned about, or whether it's just kind of a remnant of dreams. But those first few moments of the morning, that's an interesting time.
Have you ever woken up and thought you're in one place when you're in another?
Oh, truly.
For this person, this character in the story, you've got two or three different ways to wake up. But then in the end, it's not really about waking up. It's about being awake. Could you talk about that for just a second?
I think this is a... I think a good piece of fiction has universal truths in it. And one of the things that I realize the older I get is that being awake, being aware, being present, being mindful, that these are things that we don't think about necessarily in our early years. And this is taking that larger notion of being awake in your own life and puts it into just a small story. Here she realizes that she needs to be awake, not just in her marriage, but really in her life. She needs to take control of her life in a way that she hasn't up until now. And that's supposed to be a lesson in a way for myself as the writer, for the reader, hopefully.
Was there anything about you in this piece? I mean, I'm not saying in your marriage, so to speak, but just the idea of being awake, being present, is it?
Well, I think that's the work of the second half of life, right?
Is
we've kind of gotten through some of the, our basic development, and we start to realize that we need to pay more, at least I found it that I needed to pay more attention to kind of being conscious of my choices.
Now, you consider this a flash fiction piece?
Yes.
Okay. And flash is becoming more popular today, more contests, more people experimenting with this.
Definitely.
Yeah. Could you talk about what that genre is compared to the short story? Just a second.
Sure. Well, there are different definitions of flash, but I think most people would consider it to be fiction of under 1,000 words. And for different contests, there might be different lengths. There's a contest of 53-word flash fiction, fiction under 500 or under 750. But generally speaking, under 1,000 is considered flash fiction. And it's particularly interesting because you have to tell a complete story with an economy of words. And so that requires compression of thought. There's not a lot of character development. So you have to do a lot of work in a short space in order to make it work. And you can see the appeal of it. I mean, the novel's an appealing form as well, but a novel is a multi-year, extensive, brain-bending kind of idea, of concept, whereas I can write a good piece of flash fiction in, a first draft in just a few minutes and then spend some time honing it and at the end of a couple of days have a piece that I think is ready to be read in the world. So you can see the appeal of that for writers.
True, but nonetheless, to get it right, it does take work. I mean, it's not just one draft and you're done.
Absolutely, yes. Right. But compared to a traditional short story, which might be between 1,000 and 10,000 words or so, it's really almost a different form because of the economy of language, because of the need to be immediate. And so it has particular appeal, but also it does have its own challenges. I don't pretend to be a poet or to even understand how poets create what they create, but I think it's closer to that in terms of trying to get every word right.
And is there any particular, are you drawn more to flash fiction, to short story, to novel? What are you drawn to the most?
Oh, I'm kind of equal opportunity.
Okay.
I have a novel I'm finishing and another that I'm working on. I do love short stories because of the ability to develop characters and tell a tale over a certain period of time. But flash has a particular appeal just because it can be written and done and I can move on to something else. You know, when you work a novel, completion is so far off in the future. It's nice to have at least something that I can complete and be finished with.
Now, in the opening remarks, I mentioned that you were co-founder of Charlotte Center for Literary Arts, otherwise known as Charlotte Lit. Is that a place where aspiring writers can go to experiment with flash fiction and short stories and other genres?
Yes, absolutely. We run about 50 classes a year, and we run classes on all of these different forms. And we also have time for people to be able to just come and write and to be able to share their work with each other.
You have another piece you're going to read today. It's also short. It's called The Window. this would be considered flash fiction as well?
Right. This is actually about half the length of the one I read at the beginning. This is only about 350 words.
And I think in the opening I mentioned that the window had a double meaning. Can you comment on that, or will that give too much away?
Well, let me do that.
Should we read it first, and then we'll talk about
it? Let's do that after.
Okay.
Window. It's too hot to think. Too hot and too close. How could anyone work in this space? Thank God the window is open. She moves closer, and traffic sounds float up. How far down is it? 25 stories? She wonders that she can even hear the cars. She sits on the windowsill, turning her face to the wind, trying to clear her head. The familiar feeling transports her, and for a moment she is reading in the bay window on Magnolia Street, the sun and the breeze on her skin. Through that window, she sees her sister playing with the neighborhood boys, tag or football or something, physical in a way that never felt right to her. Her sister, far more interested in matters of the flesh. Which explains why they are in this room on this day. Explains the betrayal. Explains just about everything. The dare just comes to her, a fragment of an idea not fully formed. Not reasonable, not something she'd ever consider. But then, why not? Maybe it isn't so unreasonable. People do it all the time. People with a bias for action. People of the flesh. She looks down at the street, edges closer to the opening. Why shouldn't I? She says to them. Neither responds, so she turns to him. There's a question you have to answer. It's the only one I'll ever ask. She breathes in, holds it. She needs to know if he's still in love with her. She doesn't want to ask, must ask. It's the only thing she wants to know. But the question stalls on her lips. For a moment, a second stretching to millennia, she hears the far-off hum of cars in the street below, the throb of a heartbeat. And in the room, the sound that stillness makes, the lie that stillness tells. The question changes as she speaks it, becomes the right question, the only question. Which one of us do you love more? The next thing she knows, there is wind in her ears and the traffic sounds getting louder. She never got to hear the answer, but she knew what it was.
So, Paul, do we have any happy endings in the writings?
Well, I've been writing in the mystery genre, okay. And there tend to be, you might get satisfaction and you might get justice, but you tend not to get happy, per se, in your endings.
Gotcha. So now back to the title. Open the window. Did you start out with this idea that turned into the ending, or did you start out looking into a different window?
Well, this piece comes from so in the novel that I'm shopping right now, this actually was written as the prologue to that novel, and it's been since removed.
Because she dies in the opening scene.
Well. This is a piece of backstory. This is something that happens 30 years before the present day of the novel. But once I realized that it didn't live within the novel very well because it didn't foreshadow particularly well. It didn't really tell a piece of the story that needed to be told until the end. But when I removed it, I realized it actually lived very well as a story all on its own. And so the window's meaning is she literally sits on a windowsill. Of an office building. It's supposed to be a county courthouse or a city courthouse. And the other window is that she gets to see clearly something that she wasn't able to see. So in that conversation with, in this case, it's her husband and her sister, she gets to see the truth that had been hidden from her or that she refused to see previously.
And you've dealt with the difficult topic of suicide.
Well, suicide is a central component of the novel. The novel opens with a suicide and is actually spurred in a way by this death that happens 30 years earlier. It is meant to be ambiguous whether this is a suicide or a murder. And in different versions of this story, I make it more clear one way or the other, but it's meant in this version to be ambiguous. Did she fall or was she pushed from that?
So now we got to wait to get the book to find out what happened.
That's right. but I have been, there is, suicide is something I think we, most of us have experienced someone that we know who is who's taken their life, or people who have contemplated, who've had suicidal ideations. I think it's, and it's becoming more common now, especially with young people. And so that it sits particularly on my mind as, I mean, I have teenage children at home, and the stresses and anxieties are higher on them. And I think of the friends of mine and friends of my family members who, you know, we find out they die young, and then no one will actually say what has happened to them. And what we know is, you know, that they took their own exit.
We're going to transition now to the last piece you're going to read today, titled Running the Trees. This won an award with the Charlotte Writers Club, correct?
Yes, this won the Elizabeth Simpson Smith Short Story Competition.
All right, so now we've got a complete short story, and we're going to read. That's one of the benefits here of Charlotte Readers Podcast. We're not on the clock, okay? So we can we don't, you know, typically when you have contests and people stand up to read, they put a time limit on you, so you're not under the 5-minute time limit. We're going to get to hear the whole story, and it's a good one, so I hope the audience hangs with us here. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
Running the Trees. I'll confess that after a time, it wasn't about the trees anymore. It was about the girl. I'd started this as a civic duty, volunteering to plant trees. Buffalo, New York had once been the city of trees, but there proved to be something even worse for trees than unregulated developers and Dutch elm disease. Snow. Snow arriving a month too early, that is. A freak snowstorm bullied its way in the previous October, piling up on trees that had not yet shed their leaves. Many trees just fell, defeated. Most remained standing, but overladen limbs snapped, leaving behind jagged wounds. It was thought that every one of Buffalo's 50,000 trees had been damaged. Now, Buffalo and snow go together, and not because they rhyme. Snow is part of my city's identity, not like, say, the Space Needle, a man-made icon with man-made meaning. No, Buffalo's relate to our snow because it's legit. We didn't place it here, it's part of here. And maybe because it's not for sissies. Winter is something to be survived, to be toughed out. Buffalonians are tough bastards. We don't flee the snow, we welcome it. But this was an affront, an insult. This could not be allowed to stand. And so hundreds of volunteers worked to re-tree the city. The local newspaper got behind the effort with promo space and employee time, and since they're the ones who write my paycheck, I got on board. Every weekend and one evening each week, I joined the volunteers. Our mission? Plant 20,000 trees. I'll confess that I loved it. It was hard work, but as noted, that's nothing new around here. Shovel snow, shovel dirt, the muscles are the same. Same sense of accomplishment. Clean driveway, newly planted tree. Differences, too. For one, a lot less clothing planting trees, and sweating that feels good and natural the way it does when I run. There is nothing good to be said about sweating inside your thermal unders while digging out your driveway. Another difference, planting young trees requires a long-term view. Frail now, these oaks and maples would become behemoths, sturdy and resilient someday. An apt metaphor for Buffalo itself. Plant with care, develop deep roots, survive almost anything. So here's where I was, all about the trees, taking the long view. Then came the girl. I'm a reporter given to noticing. Things as they are, things as they aren't. Things in place, things amiss. And women, most of all. It's a weakness, I'll confess. One benefit of planting trees, meeting women at the dig sites. Before she showed up, I'd dated two already. We were planting in North Buffalo one Wednesday evening, a pricey neighborhood, replacing trees along a half mile of grassy medians. I noticed her immediately when she arrived at the work site. About my age, mid-20s, remarkably fit. Remarkably, in the true sense of the word, it deserved to be remarked upon. I walked over and said, by way of introduction, "I'll bet you can handle a shovel." I turned to the guy with her and said, "You? I'm not so sure." The girl and I, and my dig partner, we all thought this was funny. The guy, not so much. I know, not cool to bust a guy in front of his gal. But I didn't care. I'll confess there was something about the guy I didn't like, an intuitive sense I sometimes get, even if I can't immediately place the feeling or its source. It's the same sense that helps make me a good reporter. So like a reporter, I decided to keep my eye on them and see what developed. Whenever someone arrives at their first planting site, an experienced team adopts and teaches them. Because we'd been the first to greet them, my dig partner and I took on these two. It's a small task, takes just a few minutes to tell newbies all they need to know. How to know where to dig the hole, how deep to dig, how wide the hole, how to place the tree, how to replace the soil, how much mulch, how much water. The woman, she introduced herself as Ellen, seemed to appreciate the advice. The guy wanted nothing to do with me or my advice, never even said his name. "We got it," he said, to every explanation, speaking for them both. "Yeah, yeah, we've got it." After the lesson, my partner and I moved on to our digging spots, but kept an eye on them to make sure they did, in fact, get it. I had trouble focusing on my work, my gaze continuously drawn back to Ellen. She wore a tank top that showed off her shoulders and triceps, which she employed with vigor, commanding a shovel as few could, women or men. Her hair was brunette, pulled tight in a hangout of the back of her Buffalo Bills cap. I love all things female, it's true, but I'm not enamored by the beauty industrial complex. Unneeded makeup, unreal nails, unmoving hair. Ellen had none of these things. She was all natural, no makeup, her own nails, and not afraid to break a sweat. The guy, though. The more I watched, the less I liked him. There was something about the way he behaved with her. It wasn't love or fondness or even pride that such a woman would choose him, but I couldn't yet put my finger on it. Like attracts like. Fitness attracted fitness. They didn't match up. He was good-looking enough, but he was soft, lazy even. His work ethic showed it. She obviously took care of herself, worked out. In a fight, I'd pick her. What was she doing with him? My eyes were on her, but I soon noticed the looks I was getting from him. That's when I understood what was bugging me. He was being proprietary with her. I'd missed it because it had been so long since I had seen such a thing. It was high school nonsense. "You looking at my girlfriend, huh?" Being of a proprietary nature, the guy sure didn't like my gaze being on his girl. And so I smiled at him. Smiled and touched the brim of my baseball cap, a mock salute. Which you could take as, "Congratulations, sir, on your fine conquest, or "Screw you, pal, I'm not only looking at your woman, I'm taking her from you." The more I thought about it, the more I wanted to do just that. For my run the next evening, I ran the trees we'd planted the night before. I did this a lot. It connected me back to the work. I helped do this. Running that night, as on so many others, I admired how volunteers had cared enough to make the tree line perfectly straight. It's not difficult. The organizers make a grid out of stakes and rope, but you still had to care enough to get it right. That's Buffalonians for you. Pride in their city meant pride in their work. I ran along the median, thinking about how these oaks and maples would soon outgrow me, and then outlive me. Freak snowstorms permitting. A few shifts after the first appearance of Ellen and the guy, there was a clear chilliness between them. Before they'd even begun, I saw her stalk away from him. I chose to see this as an opportunity. "Need a partner?" I said. There was something unnerving and thrilling about being with Ellen while her stooge of a boyfriend was nearby. We talked freely, although I was careful not to get too near her. I like to be provocative, but there are limits. Like all journalists, I suppose, we'll poke the bear, but we're not going to get eaten. And more than not wanting to get hit, I didn't want to be used. But the more I spent time with Ellen, the less I thought her capable of using me, and the more I liked her. She was beautiful, that I had known. Now I was learning that she was also warm and funny, smart and kind. Finally, I had to ask her. "Ellen," I said. She turned her attention from the tree to me. We'd been talking for an hour by then, and she must have been able to detect something in my tone. "Don't," she said. The look in her eyes said everything. She was trapped, and she was afraid. "How bad?" She shook her head, practically a twitch, nearly imperceptible. She wouldn't answer or couldn't. Beautiful, warm, funny, smart, and kind. And damaged. My inner voice was screaming, "Stand down!" There was no fixing the damage, whatever it was. I could not save her, not from this guy, not from her past, not from herself. I'll confess that I knew already I wasn't going to listen to the voice. I was a freak storm, about to wreak havoc on whatever was in my path. The next tree planting day, Ellen came alone. She was looser, funnier, warmer, and I began to see what she'd be like if she were free of him. What we'd be like. A few years on the newspaper's police beat, and I'd seen more than a lifetime's share of domestic violence. always after the fact when the woman had already been beaten, sometimes beaten to death. This, I understood, was what it looked like before. Reporters are not comfortable with the inexplicable. I've long wondered, and had even researched, why did they stay? But that's a psychological rabbit hole, tunneling into passive aggressiveness, dominance and submission, love and hate, safety and fear. And sometimes in the simple fact of the abused having no safe place to go. We dug holes, we planted trees, and she was a delightful partner. Could I be her safe place? I decided something that was not my decision to make. She couldn't return to him. I couldn't allow it. Where are you headed after here? I asked. Ellen said, I don't have anywhere to be. You don't live with him? Or maybe you've left him? I'm sure she could hear the hopefulness in my voice. He's away for a few days. I contemplated this, then bolted forward, the storm in my head swirling. Would you let me take you out tonight? She hesitated. Just out, I said, so we can keep talking. Doesn't have to be a date. It's either a date or it's not, she said. A date, then, I said. She nodded, just the barest tip of her head. I'm a writer, but I can't describe the look in her eyes. I'll confess I was expecting gratitude, hopefulness, maybe even joy. Instead, there was another storm lurking there, something uncontrollable, dark, and inevitable. I felt it like a stab in the chest, because I was all in now. I couldn't change my mind if I wanted to. We spent the weekend together, and it was magnificent. I don't know that I'd ever felt so at ease, so at home with anyone, and there had been a lot of anyones. Sunday night she went home, promising to return in an hour with her bag packed. She never arrived. A reporter knows to take notes, to write everything down, to confirm the details, but I'd failed to get Ellen's phone number, or address, or email, or, it's hard to confess this, her last name. I had no way to find her. It would be 3 days before the next dig, and all I could do was wait. Wednesday night after work, I got to that week's planting site early. Every car that approached got my attention. But when their car arrived, only he was in it. I reached him before he'd gotten a yard from his car. Where is she? I said, standing closer than was reasonable. Not here, obviously, he said and pushed past me. I knew what this meant. She'd changed her mind, or he'd found out. Either way, she was staying with him, and he wasn't letting her near me. How had I let this happen? I should have gone with her, stayed with her, extracted her, saved her from him. And there he was, digging like he didn't have a care in the world. What was he doing there anyway without her? He didn't give a good goddamn about the trees. At the end of the shift, shovel in hand, I confronted him again. Where is she? She's done with you, he said. You'll never see her again, or me. That's why he was there, to deliver a message. He had won, and Ellen was lost. My concern for her was approaching panic. I'd have followed the guy home, but I had ridden my bicycle to the digs. There was no way. Still, a reporter carries a notebook, and this time I did my job. I got down his license plate. I rode home, put on clean clothes over my dig-dirty body, and drove to the newspaper. As a police beat reporter, I had access. I easily got the guy's address in South Buffalo and drove over there. A stakeout, a dangerous and stupid thing to do, but the only thing more stupid would be knocking on the door. The house was a bungalow typical of the neighborhood, aggressive roof lines and bold colors well tended. In the lighted windows I could see him, but not her. When the lights went out hours later, I lay back in the car seat and slept, badly. I was awake at first light, again watching. He left around 8. I went up to the house and rang the bell, and knocked, hammered on the door, looked in the windows. Nothing. As far as I could tell, she wasn't in there. This is crazy, I told myself. Maybe reporting it tainted me, made me see villains everywhere. Maybe it was Occam's razor. The simplest explanation was she didn't live with him. She was safe at home, wherever that was. I went to work, disheveled and filthy, but no one seemed to notice me. Not until I did something unexpected. I screamed. On my desk was an assignment, a police report with a photograph of a missing woman. My woman. The next 2 days were frantic, a blur, covering the story, trying to get interviews, tracking down her background. The police looked for the boyfriend, whose name was actually John Smith, a generic name for an all-too-generic story, abuser-turned-murderer. I told the police a quarter truth about my involvement, mentioned only the trees and what I'd observed there. The paper would yank me from the story if I said any more. I could testify later about the rest if it came to that. I was better off searching on my own. But no one found anything. By Friday night, there was still no sign of Ellen or her killer. I went home from the paper, worn out but restless. It's counterintuitive, but the best remedy for exhaustion sometimes is to go for a run, and I wanted to run the trees. I'd been on dozens of plantings by then, so I had many options, but I went where I was drawn, the place I first met Ellen. The site in North Buffalo was a wide boulevard, about a half mile long, divided by grass medians, islands of green, and trees. I ran back and forth along this route, noticing how this neighborhood had merited slightly older trees than some other planting sites, maybe because it was a muddied area or because of the age of the lost trees. I ran the trees, up and back, half mile each length. As one who notices things, I paid attention to something different each pass. Architecture on one pass, landscaping on another. After I'd been six or seven times, I paid special attention to the straightness of the tree line. Every tree for a half mile across a half dozen grassy islands in perfect alignment, except for one. The last tree on the last median was off true by 1 foot. There had been massive damage at the end of that street where it ended in a cul-de-sac. Several large trees had been uprooted by the weight of the snow, and they'd crashed down on the houses. All three in the cul-de-sac were vacant now, uninhabitable, undergoing renovations. I inspected the site of that offline tree. The hole that had been dug was much bigger than necessary for the tree that was planted there. There was mulch spread over the digging spot, but not enough to cover the area. I took out my phone and made 2 calls, to 911 and to my newspaper. I told them both the same thing. I had just found where Ellen was buried. The yellow crime scene tape was strung across the cul-de-sac, with the fulcrum being one of the new baby oak trees, the next one in the planting line. I had planted that tree myself. Ellen and the bastard who killed her had planted the one that marked her grave. The newspaper photographer and I stood behind the tape and watched the careful digging. At some point they stopped, and the lead detective was called over. He peered into the hole, then looked over at me. Grim-faced, he nodded. Later, after more digging and many police photographs, a stretcher was lowered in. I didn't want to watch, couldn't not watch. I stood next to the photographer, and as the stretcher came up, he lifted his camera. The next thing I knew, I was on the ground. Something had happened to my legs. They wouldn't hold me up. The stretcher carried the body of John Smith. The detective had me by the arm, was hauling me to my feet. "This time, you're going to tell us everything," he said. In an interrogation room, I did. Again and again. Over the course of the night, I moved from reporter to eyewitness to suspect to patsy to sap. Their conclusion, she'd played me. Maybe that she meant to set me up. Eventually, they let me go. I went to the paper to help file the story while the police continued their search for Ellen. They never thought to look for her in the place where she turned up, sitting at my desk. The entire time I was being interrogated, the newspaper had been trying to pry me loose. I thought it was because they cared about me. Instead, it was because the final deadline was approaching, and the suspect was sitting in my chair, refusing to speak to anyone but me. Yeah, sure, I suppose the paper should have told the police she was there, but getting an exclusive from the suspect herself was too good to pass up. Not to mention that she had promised to let me take her in, after she'd told me her story. "It's all right," I said when I saw her. "You're all right." She was crying, had been crying. Of course she wasn't all right. Together, we assembled the pieces. Sunday night, after she'd left my place with the intention of moving out of the house she shared with John Smith, she got home to find him there, back earlier than expected. He'd been there since the night before, waiting for her, wondering where she was, who she'd been with. She had to tell him everything. He responded by locking her in the basement, keeping her prisoner for days. On Wednesday, he went to the dig site alone, where I had confronted him. He had gone to declare victory, as I had guessed, to show me that Ellen was still his. Except that Ellen wasn't his. Despite what he believed would happen, her imprisonment hadn't taught her a lesson. Instead, it had hardened her resolve. By Thursday, he realized he'd lost her, and that she would have him arrested for unlawful imprisonment. When I had seen him leave alone that morning, when I was staking him out, he was going scouting, figuring out how and where to kill her. Thursday night he took Ellen to the cul-de-sac and had her dig her own grave, digging up the last tree in the line and making a hole big enough for her body. It made sense. She was much better with a shovel than he. And of course, he had to be able to watch her, to keep her from running, to keep her quiet. It was a nearly perfect spot. The damaged houses at the end of the street were vacant. Construction equipment parked there hid them from view of the houses further along the row. And it was late, around midnight. One neighbor did come down there walking her dog. John Smith told her they had planted the tree themselves, and once they realized it was off-center, were eager to fix it. The tree hadn't been off-center, of course, but it made for a good enough story. The woman and her dog went away, satisfied, although she returned the next night to speak to the police, identifying Ellen from a photograph as the woman she'd seen. When the hole was done, Ellen climbed out. Smith had a baseball bat and he came for her. Ellen swung first, the shovel one blow to the head, which killed him. In a fight I had thought the first day I met them, I'd pick her. She should have called the police. That would have been rational. What she did was rational, too, in its way. You've just killed a man with a shovel after digging what was meant to be your own grave. Different rules of rationality might apply. What Ellen wanted in that moment was for him to be gone. She didn't want to be, forever, the domestic violence victim who'd killed a man in self-defense. She didn't want his shadow over her entire life. So she pushed the body into the hole and covered it up. When she replanted the tree, she intentionally placed it just off-center. She took his last lie and made it true. She didn't know I ran the trees, didn't know that I noticed things. Things that are as they should be, and things that are not. Just as I had noticed that something was amiss in her life, too. Later, more clear-headed, Ellen understood she had to come forward, that his hold on her would be greater if she ran, because then she'd have to keep running, running forever from that tree and what had happened there. Her story made the next morning's front page. While the presses were churning, I took Ellen to the police station, where she surrendered. They put us in separate rooms, and we both told our stories again and again. She spent a few days in the local hold, but in the end, the district attorney declined to charge her. Self-defense, followed by an irrational act, they couldn't make stick, didn't want to. They decided not to charge me, either. Accessory after the fact. Obstruction of justice. Something. They could have, and that one, they could have made stick. When they released Ellen, she came to stay with me, and a year later we're still together. We don't talk about what happened anymore. The damage from the killing beneath the trees will be with us always, and we don't know yet if it will be fatal to our relationship, too. The damage I saw in her is still there, of course, along with any damage I carry myself, including the damage that makes me want to be the savior, regardless of the costs. I'll confess I don't know if I stay because I want to or because I should. I'll confess these might be the same thing. In Buffalo, more than 20,000 trees have been planted, joining about twice that number which survived the freak storm. When you look at the old trees now, you see resilience, enthusiastic blooms on the good limbs, even as you can also see the scars from that fateful day. The shape of every tree is different now, changed. The canopy of the city changed. Those who planted changed as well. Many broken limbs remain, never to bear another leaf, jagged reminders that each life, a city, a tree, a person, must bear its damage, incorporate it, grow around it, embrace it or endure it, and stand fast, awaiting the next storm.
Paul, I can see why that story won the contest. That's a great, great piece of work.
Thank you.
You grew up in Buffalo?
I didn't. I grew up on the other side of the state in Schenectady, New York, but I went to college in Buffalo.
But it's obvious you're familiar with the area.
Yeah, I came to love that city while I was there.
Yeah, and then you didn't like snow quite as much as you liked it in this story.
No, that's a Buffalonian trait that I don't actually share.
You're one of those people that comes down here and say, they don't know how to drive in that snow. We know how to drive.
This is true. This is true. I can drive in the snow, but I stay home because of all those who don't.
I like the line, because it's not for sissies. Is that how?
That's right.
Is that how living in Buffalo is? Is that why they play outside still in Buffalo?
That's why they play outside still.
Okay.
It gives them that advantage.
The idea of just being off by one foot, found that whole metaphor. I think the language you used here, all the trees were in perfect alignment except for one. The last tree on the last meeting was off true by one foot. And her story was off true probably by more than 1 foot. But that but that image was that her trying to kind of hang on to something, or to point out that she was strong enough and she wanted people to see it?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it was maybe there's more underneath it, but it had to be a plot element. He had to have a way to discover where the body was buried. Mm-hmm. I liked the little twist I threw in there where he had lied about the reason they were digging there, and she took his last lie and made it true. Because like the character in the first story, she had been lied to about who he was and what he was offering her as a partner. And she had to find a way to get out from under that.
So too often, and I know this because I've represented women pro bono in domestic violence cases, too often, no matter what the person in that situation does, they can't escape. There's no ending that's possible like an ending in this story. And even this story, the way it ends, even though this woman escapes and is able to overcome, she doesn't really escape, does she?
Yeah, we don't really know what she won't escape what she did or escape what has happened to her. Like, none of us escape those things that happened in our past. I was following a little bit of a template here. This is meant to read like a classic noir, right? He's supposed to sound a little bit hard-boiled. He's a little bit, women are right. Kind of objectified to him.
He can save the day. He can
save the day.
He's going to fix this.
Right? And by the end of the story, he should come to realize that that the way he's viewed the world is not necessarily the right way. You know, women were more object and plaything, and by the end, he sees her more clearly, but he also sees himself more clearly by the end.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you for joining us today. You've given us some great stories, something to think about, and look forward to connecting with you at Charlotte Lit.
Landis, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
So that's it for today. Another author giving voice to their written words. Thank you for listening to Charlotte Readers Podcast. If you liked our show, please tell your friends. And if you really liked it, you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and by subscribing to the show wherever you listen to it, which you can do for free. Please remember our Season 1 sponsor, Park Road Books. They're right there in Park Road Shopping Center. Drop by the store. You'll be glad you did. And don't forget to check out charlottereaderspodcast.com and the free ebook you can get by signing up for our email list. Speaking of email, my email address is on the website, and I'd love to hear from you. Tell me what you like about the show. Tell me what you'd like to see different. And if you have the name of a Charlotte area author you'd like to hear from, give me the name, and I'll follow up. You can like us on Facebook and tweet at us on Twitter. We're going to try to put these shows out on a weekly basis. And next week, we have another talented author coming to read their work. Until then, I'm Landis Wade for Charlotte Readers Podcast.